Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, November 18th. And we're happy to be here with you this morning. I'm your host, Magnus Tevold, and joining me in the studio today are...
It's Peter R.H.
And Senya.
Great. Nice to have you all here. Peter, of course, is our regular correspondent.
Correspondent? Journalist? I don't know. What do I correspond?
Our regular contributor. And Senya is... new to our public affairs department here at CJSF. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. all right, we have some good stuff lined up for the show today. We're going to talk a little bit about Crab Park coming up in a few minutes. Crab Park is what was, for almost 3 years, Canada's only legally sanctioned homeless encampment, and it got... shut down just over a week ago. What are you going to talk to us about today, Peter?
Well, I'm going to talk about the polio vaccine. And what was interesting was I sort of... there's this Dan Wilson. He does a YouTube channel called Debunk the Funk. And I'm part of the funk, as I admitted a few months ago, that I have not got the COVID vaccine, you know. But the other thing is that I'm not one of those that say don't get the other ones, because and it's interesting, the polio vaccine doesn't as such make you not get polio, but it's the actual muscles, like it actually prevents you getting that awful thing where for the rest of your life you can't move properly. So it's interesting. And now JFK Jr. is now health minister.
RFK Jr., yeah. Right, well, we'll get back to that later.
But I would like to actually, this is kind of important. I made an error on the last show.
Well, why don't we?
Okay, well, I'll get back to that. But
yeah,
I wanna,
we can, when we get back to your segment, we'll get into that. All right, so we've talked to folks from the Crab Park encampment down on Crab Park, which is on the shores of Burrard Inlet, just by the C-Bus station at the foot of Main Street in Vancouver. It was Canada's only legally sanctioned homeless encampment for almost 3 years. A couple of years ago, when the Parks Board rolled in to try and shut it down, with the support of some legal help, they were able to challenge that action and get an injunction preventing the Parks Board and the City of Vancouver from shutting down the site. And for more than 2 years, the campers who lived there and the city and the Parks Board kind of worked together to make the camp work. I think it was always a tense relationship. And over the last year, the Parks Board and the city have taken a lot of actions which have slowly squeezed the camp. A number of things, such as forcing everyone to take down their camps and take down their tents and move it somewhere else while they went in and cleaned the area. Other sort of actions which made it less and less comfortable for the community there. Last week, on November 7th, the City of Vancouver and the Parks Board moved in and finally cleared out the camp. The camp and its advocates knew this was going to be happening, and did what they could, but pretty much the writing was on the wall at this point. The campers and their advocates did go on a trip to Ottawa to bring their case about homelessness and the need for action and appropriate housing to the federal government and to MPs in Ottawa. But on the 7th, the camp was finally shut down and the area fenced off. About a year ago, I talked to Clint Brandon, and we took a tour of the camp. And I'm going to replay a part of that interview just so you can get a sense of what that camp environment was like. I was also down there on Friday the 8th, the day after the camp was closed down, and talked to a couple of people who are still hanging around. There's one tent and a few people, and some Parks Board folks came by and talked to them briefly. And later, by the end of the weekend, that was all gone as well. But I'm going to play you a little segment of that conversation from last Friday, or well, a week ago Friday. And then we'll revisit our tour of the camp from December 2023. Do you mind giving your name?
I prefer not to. I mean, those that know me, know me. Shout out to Shadow and Ducky and all the others. Hey, hey.
Yeah. Okay. So why have you decided to stay here? Well, everything was supposed to be, you know, taken away and packed up, and here you are still.
Well, the majority of this stuff actually belongs to our head of security, who is actually the guy that, from what I'm to understand, has in his mind probably more planning than a lot of people, I think, realize or appreciate. Right. I'm just here trying to make sure that all the campers who are still here who are displaced by the Parks Board and the City of Vancouver's angle and approach to these matters don't feel like they've just been like sort of left in the dust,
right.
How to put that, in the throes of everything else, sort of scattered to the wind kind of concept. That's what we're trying to avoid.
Right. Because there's a real community here.
There is, and, you know, and that's the funny thing. I'd say it's even as much as a few different communities, which ultimately form a larger and more comprehensive one in that regard. So it's ultimately, it starts to feel on a very, I'd almost say, integral and tribal level, like a family. Like it becomes multifaceted in that nature. So it becomes, how to put that, it becomes imperative to have that level of culpability and, I guess, support. Because otherwise, well, then it's not there. It's not a presence that we would then be embracing. So God, that's a difficult one to put to words sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think that's mainly because of the, let's call it the lack of familiarity of the past few months. Right? When it's not paradise, you know, it's tumultuous to say the least. But when it's not that, it is and has been pretty good.
The fact that people choose to form these communities, you know, speaks to something, don't you think? You know, for a lot of people, the people who chose to be here, they chose to be a part of this community.
Well, that's largely due to systemic problems.
Right.
And so one of the reasons that there is that level of familiarity is because of the systemic issues that are occurring to people, mass and widespread.
Yeah.
So when the parks rangers say that the people of Crab Park accepted housing, what they actually mean is that because of the intimidation, very passive though it may be, that has been present, whether or not it's their doing or someone else's doing or just accidental, because of that level of intimidation that's been going on, there is this notion that people would otherwise have to either accept the thing that very well just will leave them houseless or homeless in the next month or two, or under 2 years was the problem that a lot of people were facing. After 2 years, from what I'm to understand, most of the housing options that were available for people historically from Tent City and otherwise through Carnegie and other places like that would then be able to, with little to no reason, oust a resident of whichever building, and that would be that. For what it's worth, it just seems like they're avoiding issues. And so if they're avoiding the issues, then I don't know, there's only so much one can do at that point.
Right.
It's kind of actually terrifying in a way.
And you mentioned you're sort of scouting for potential other places that people might be able to go if needed.
Well, since the day I got here at Crab Park and met Fiona York, we actually had a good conversation. I had been looking for alternative locations, do a significant amount of scouting in and around the rail yards and industrial sectors.
All right. Well, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks. That was recorded just over a week ago on the day after the crab parking encampment was shut down. At that point, as I mentioned, the area taken up by the camp on the, if you're familiar with the park, on the point near, there's a little fishing pier there, which is where the camp was situated, has been fenced off, and everything removed and gravel spread out and whatnot. A year ago, the camp was quite vibrant with 16 or 17 tents and 45 residents in a relatively neatly contained area. It certainly didn't prevent people from using the park, as it took up only a small section over at one side, and much of the rest of the park, the large lawn and the playground areas and all the rest of it was still available for the public to use. But it's interesting to hear from one of the residents as we went down there to the camp and itself and talked about the camp and toured around, and important for you to get a sense of what life was like there, and but also perhaps even more importantly what role it played for the people who lived there. One of the things that people many homeless complain about, and one of the reasons in many cases they choose not to move into offered home housing or stay there, is because a lot of that housing doesn't quite meet their needs, particularly with, there's often a lot of restrictions. You know, they're not entirely treated as adults. They're not allowed to have visitors. They're, you know, many things like that that make it feel not really like a home of their own and something that they can sustain with. And sometimes, you know, and so an encampment like the Crab Park encampment, which offers some degree of stability and a community that comes with it, is often a really attractive alternative. And it's one of the reasons these encampments keep showing up again and again and again. Between the fact that it actually serves a need for this community that isn't met elsewhere, and, you know, perhaps that we as a society are not willing to commit the resources needed to solve the problem in a better way than we have. As we know, whether it's homelessness or addiction or mental health services, the resources available prove to be inadequate year after year after year, often presenting only Band-Aids and not enough to really address the needs that are there. And that's a whole issue we have to grapple with as a society. Anyway, I'm going to play this interview. We're going to play just a portion of it. But it does, I think, give you a really good insight into what life in the camp was like, and perhaps more significantly, what it offered the people who found community there. This is me talking with camper and advocate someone taking on a leadership role within that community, Clint Brandon, in December 2023. Okay. May you start out by introducing yourselves?
I'm Clint Brandon.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So tell me a bit about the camp here. We're at Crab Park.
Yep.
And how long has the camp been here?
Well, the camp originally now has been legal for, I believe it's 2.5, 3 years now. We've got the court order to be here now. Up before that, though, it was another 2 years that we sat here struggling and fighting up on the hill here. And it's been a hard battle, right? Like, we actually, it's still kind of overwhelming some days that we even got the victory, because it's the first legal encampment that's out there, right? And it's created a snowball effect, like a domino effect all the way around the world, right, where people are starting to fight for their rights, and you know, hopefully the idea here is like, there's still a lot of work to be done, but the idea is to show that you know, just because people are homeless doesn't mean that they're useless and they're worthless, and you know, we all have problems in life and we all have things that we got to struggle against, but you know, everybody's got something to give, right? And there's a lot of skilled people here that have something to give, and we want to show the world that we can take care of ourselves. We don't need to you know, like, we just hand up, not a handout, right? Like, this is what we're kind of looking for. Yeah. So, and so far, it's Yeah, it's just everyday small victories, right?
So what difference did it make when you got that court order and the camp became legal as opposed to when it was here as an illegal camp?
A lot of people came together even more so than when we were fighting originally, right? Like, mm-hmm. like there's now inside the camp, you know, it's like, I mean, I know there's lots of rumors that fly around about these places, and I'm not necessarily saying that they're always incorrect, but like we got a different kind of camp here where even if there's personal issues with each other, it doesn't come down to fighting and beating people up and assaulting people. And when it comes to standing up for the camp, we all band together always to stick to the camp first, right, and take care of each other. New people come in and they need something, we always supply it, right? Everybody's welcome here. Anybody that needs a hand up or anything we can give is welcome to anybody, right? And we got to be, I got to be honest, we got it pretty good here. Like, we've got regular food all the time, and we've got, you know, we got a warming can if anybody's cold and just needs to warm up. It's pretty decent for an outdoor shelter camp, right?
That's good. What kind of community exists here?
Like I said, it started out as when we were on the hill, it was a little bit more of your average kind of tent city that was, you know, I mean, you still got your standard problems like any homeless, you know, place has, right? You got addiction issues and things like that. But we tried to set some guidelines and rules here with, you know, just basic human respect, right? And no stealing, no lying. You know, we try to deal with our own problems, but at the same time, we try to act a little bit a step above the average, right. You know, homeless individual. And whether we do or not, who knows, but we try, right?
So is there sort of a, like a committee or some sort of governments that helps you to make decisions?
We usually do, for the most part, we work on a seniority system, right? Whoever's been here the longest and basically has taken that leadership role on. Like, we don't necessarily vote anybody in, but we kind of do as well, I guess. It's kind of right in between there, right? We don't have any official voting system, but, mm-hmm. Like I've been here since day one. I'm part of the original 20. My wife's part of the original 20. I think we have two other people that are still here that are part of the original 20 members that started this, like, 4.5 years ago. But, and then we have some other senior members that have been here, you know, 2-3 years as well. And basically, seniority is the number one thing, because then, you know, seniority relates to experience, right?
Yeah.
So that's the biggest thing we do.
Do you have regular meetings, or?
We do. We were having weekly meetings, but now we've reduced them to, I think we're going monthly, basically, kind of right. when we need them, right? Because
yeah.
The weekly meetings were just to the point where a lot of people were talking about a lot of stuff, but nothing was getting accomplished. So we decided that, you know, maybe it's best if we reduce the amount of time meeting and a little bit more time doing, right? So, and we've just been working out, in my opinion, right? Like when things start to build up, then we have another meeting and reorganize and restructure and start again, usually once, twice a month.
Right. So what are the kind of issues that come up that might make you feel you need a meeting to talk about things?
Fire safety, spacing between the tents, right, because that's a big fire issue. Something we got going with the park board right now is because obviously this is a public park space, right? And it wasn't obviously designated to support a small community, right? It was designed for public usage. And so you got issues with the fire department and all that, especially with the fire department fire codes, right? Like, everything we need to survive is basically considered a fire restriction, right? So there's an argument there. At the same time, you know, a lot of these tents and what they do allow us to use are more flammable than the stuff that is actually considered a restriction, right? Like, I know these tents will go up a lot quicker than something made out of wood, right? But we're not allowed to have pallets and things like that, right? But, you know, that's where the heads clash a little bit. And we're trying to meet with the park board and trying to come to a middle ground, right? Which is, I'm hoping over the last couple of weeks we've actually broken through and gotten some better communication on the go, right? Because I just attended a meeting a couple of days ago, and it seems like they're a little more open-minded to working something out. We had an incident about a week ago up on the hill here, because that's technically our borderline there, right? We're not supposed to come outside that borderline. This remains park space. And some of the encampments started coming up the hill a little bit, and the rangers came in and started tearing down the tents. This is the same thing they used to do to us a few years ago. They started, like, physically tearing down the tents with people inside them and throwing their stuff away. And, you know, it might look like garbage or trash to other people, but to some of us, it's the only thing we have, right? And, you know, the winter's coming and things like that, and some of those people, there's some senior citizens out there, they're 60, 70 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And now we don't know where they are, and we don't know if they're okay, we don't even know if they're alive right now, right? And the rangers throw their stuff in the back of the truck, and they claim it's going to storage, but it doesn't go to storage, it's in the garbage, we've never been able to reclaim any of it, right? And that's heartbreaking, that's overwhelming to see that, right? We try to offer someone a safe place to be, and then an arm of the government comes in and steps on us like we're You know, that was, and but on both sides, it turned into a bit of a physical altercation, the first one ever, and it was, the police had to be called for that, and it was kind of embarrassing on both parts, right? So since then, both the parks board and our side has been a little bit more, I think, open to communication, right? Because I don't want to see that, and I know no one in our encampment wants to see that, like.
So you had some talks and sort of worked out some new rules?
We started, as soon as that happened, right, that very day, I said, man, you guys can't be doing this. One of the members of our camp, and I won't mention names, but one of the members of our camp got everybody riled up that day because when the Rangers showed up. And I understand why they get riled up, and I totally get the point, and I've been there, but we're at a point now where that kind of thing just can't happen. We're not going to get anywhere with that, right? We're beyond that point, right? Like, people are listening to us and they're supporting us in a lot of ways, right? I mean, obviously we get some people who don't support us, but we actually have a lot of community support here, and so yeah, stuff like that doesn't look good for us or anybody, right? So
how involved is the city and the parks board and the fire department and the police in coming down here and interacting with you? Because I know when the camp was first set up, there was a lot of that. You know, they came and I think they took the camp down a couple times, and. You know, that, and then you guys came back and set up again, and eventually you sort of came to an agreement.
Well, what happened is they decided they were going to get they pulled an injunction on us, and they said, okay, we're pulling an injunction on us, so you know the police are going to come down with their riot squad and basically tell us, and that's a violent way to get removed from anywhere, right? Yeah. That would suck. So my wife jumped out of bed that morning, all upset, and she ran out of the tent and she says, you know what, you guys are pulling an injunction on us. She's like, fine, I'm countersuing. and that got the ball rolling, and here we are, right? As soon as that happened, we had a four-person legal team that stepped up to the plate, and they supported us pro bono, and it was amazing. We owe them everything. And it was the injunction got stopped. We beat that, and that slowed the park board down right away, and they realized that what we're doing was serious, and it wasn't, we weren't just playing around. This is life and death. This is our lives, right? And there's a lot of people here that are trying to make changes and are trying to get somewhere, right? And so, I mean, we don't want the whole park, but we want to keep it clean. We don't want to, you know, we just need somewhere safe for us to go, right? And that's what we like to believe this place is, right? There's that's the one thing is you know, we won't let other people come down here. And there was one issue that happened, an incident, and that was a tragic incident that happened, but it wasn't a member of our park. It was a member of someone up on the street that came down here and caused a bunch of assaults on a bunch of people, and that was, and ever since that day, we've gotten a bit of a reputation down here where, again, there's no violence down here. We don't tolerate violence down here, right? It was just a tragic day that came that day. It was actually really disturbing. But this is a safe community, right? We all support each other, stand up for each other. We're like a bit of a family, right? A lot of us don't have family, so this is it, right?
How important is that community to you? Because, I mean, obviously this is going to be
this is huge.
A better environment than, you know, sleeping in a doorway or isolated
and
on your own in a park.
And it's offered a lot. And it's offered a lot of opportunities. I mean, even this right now, like this type of interaction, I wouldn't be able to do a few years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Now I'm able to even interact better socially with people, right? Like, and so even for me, it's making, it's been my whole life right now. And fighting for the other people and the other homeless people that are out there, it kind of feels like whether I have a choice or not, it's a role that if me and my wife kind of took on kind of suddenly, and now we can't walk away from it now, right? Like it's,
how many people are living in the camp right now?
Winter time, it always you think it would get bigger, but actually.
Whether it be
Graham Pohl is an
okay. May you start up by introducing yourself?
I'm Clint Randon.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, exactly. Park is a member of someone up on the street that came down here and caused a bunch of assaults on a bunch of people, and that was, and ever since that day, we've gotten a bit of a reputation down here where, again, there's no violence down here. We don't tolerate violence down here, right? It was just a tragic day that came that day. It was actually really disturbing. But this is a safe community, right? We all support each other, stand up for each other. We're like a bit of a family, right? A lot of us don't have family, so this is it, right?
How important is that community to you? Because, I mean, obviously this is going to be
this is huge.
A better environment than, you know, sleeping in a doorway or isolated
and
on your own in a park.
And it's offered a lot. and it's offered a lot of opportunities. I mean, even this right now, like this type of interaction, I wouldn't be able to do a few years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Now I'm able to even interact better socially with people, right? Like,
yep.
And so, even for me, it's my whole life right now. It's and fighting for the other people and the other homeless people that are out there. It kind of feels like, whether I have a choice or not, it's a role that me and my wife kind of took on kind of suddenly, and now we can't walk away from it now, right? Right. Like, it's
how many people are living in the camp right now?
Winter time, it always you think it would get bigger, but actually gets a little bit smaller during the winter because there's people that show up in the summer that think it's some kind of resort or something. But so we're down to, I think we got about 80, 90 tents up. I think we only got a population of about 45, 50 at the moment.
Right.
Some are in and out, kind of in between housing or like temporary housing or an SRO, and they're just kind of making adjustments. And then at the same time, we have always people coming in and out. You get some people to come in over a week or a few days and things like that, and they're getting housing or they have something else on the go. We do have some people that come in and just stay for a little while. They just moved here or something, and they're getting in something, you know, so we have that as well, right? So, but I think right now we have about, last count, I think we have 45 actual full-time tenants right now.
Okay. And what sort of supports are in place in the camp as an organized and now legal camp?
We got tons of kitchens that donate food to us every day. We got larger grocery stores that donate us food. We got smaller jobs on the go, right? We got an OPS program, the overdose prevention program, which is one of our donations right now. I think that's one of our lunch donations.
Okay.
Yep. These are another. They've been donating to us for 2 years now.
Yeah.
We have a couple GoFundMes up that we're trying to get a solar power system up and stay away from the fossil fuels. Right now we have to use generators, but those we want to get away from, and those aren't they're not really financially viable, right? Like, I'm the mechanic, but I work on them all. I don't mind doing that,
yeah.
But. Just the cost for at this more donations that we got asked for. So we're trying to get a solar system actually in place, and we got a GoFundMe up for that, and then we're trying to work with the park board to see if we can get some, you know, alternative funding for that, and then whatever funding we can come up with as well, right? Like, I go to the temp service and work as much as I can, and then we got some small jobs around the camp that people get paid for. Like, we got a cooking job, and we got a clean up crew and things like that that all get paid small amounts. That all comes from donations though too, right? And so we got a limited budget, but everybody, you know, there's small employment jobs that get, which is, we're trying to work on some more employment for everybody, right? Try to get some actual funding to come in, and we're working on a proposal now where, you know, a little bit of government funds where we could actually pay people for work here, and people could maybe start some arts projects or some something, right? Something that we could maybe put back in the community that would, provide work and something to give back, right?
So why live here as opposed to, because you've been here 2 years,
yep.
You said?
Yeah, well, I've been here since the start, 4.5. But
okay. So why do you choose to live here as opposed to going into some other alternative form of housing?
Honestly, because the SRO system and it is an absolute joke. Like, they think that they're doing something good for the community, but it's not. There's nothing good for us in there. All these SROs are full of rats and disease and black mold. And I mean, the crews that work on these buildings won't even come in unless they're in full hazmat protection. But we have to live there, right?
And that's, just pause for a second for the helicopter to fly away. It's pretty noisy.
Yeah, that's the one thing. I like watching them, but that's the first view that people come in. Yeah, I guess tourists come and get to see when they pull in. Yeah.
Are you talking about the SROs?
Yeah, like I was at the Flynn Hotel for the longest time, and there's all kinds of violence and crap that goes on there, which is. Once again, it's about safety and feeling comfortable, and you know, we're stuck in the rooms in these SROs that are 90 square feet, right? And in some cases, two or three people are stuck in these rooms. They're full of cockroaches and bugs and everything else, and they say they clean up and they get the exterminators to come in. But all the exterminators do is try to keep the bugs in people's rooms, right? They spray along the doorways to keep them out of the hallways so people don't see them, right?
Right.
But they're in everybody's rooms, and it's just, like I said, people have to come and do work on the buildings. They won't even come in unless they're in full hazmat protection, but we're expected to live there, right? And that's just... I mean, that's not right. I mean, we're better off in these places. Like, I know I'm better off here. Like, I don't feel sick all the time. I don't feel run down. And I mean, in the SRO, I was. It was just, it's, it's an unhealthy building. They're 100 years old, and they're not maintained the way they're supposed to be. Lead paint on the walls, and they don't want to take care of it. And they blame BC Housing, and then BC Housing blames them, and it's just a pass the buck situation, right? So no one takes responsibility for it. Okay. So that's why most people come here.
I know when, like, for instance, the Strathcona Park camp was being taken down, you know, the promise was that everybody had housing. But I also understand a lot of the housing was pretty problematic, either very short-term or offered people no real freedoms.
Yeah, exactly.
That you'd expect as an adult, you know, no guests, you couldn't have to leave in the daytime, all sorts of things like that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. There's no guests, and if guests are allowed, it's one guest at a time, and they got to show their ID at the door or give up their ID, which they have no right to ask for in the first place, right? And yeah, like, we're all adults, and you treat them more like a youth detention jail or something, right? Like, it's I mean, I understand they got to try to maintain some control, but I mean, you have people that are you know, they've come over to this province or even this country, and they're 20, 25 years old, and they went to school for a couple of years, and they're making life and death decisions for people's lives that are you know, full grown adults in these SROs, and you know, and then you got people that have lived in this world their whole life, and they can't make their decisions anymore. You got one meal coming in a day, and if there's not enough to go around the whole building, then all they say is, "Oh, too bad. There's not a meal ticket to give them or another option." It's and then, like I said, the cleanliness is, you know, whether you keep your room clean or not, the cleanliness issue is a big deal, right? And then they're given budgets to maintain these buildings, and I don't see the money going to where it's supposed to go to. Like, I mean, I've done a lot of construction over the years, and you know, getting the paint off the walls and or getting the asbestos out and things like that is, you know, asbestos abatement is not that expensive. Like, it's, you know, I know the budget would cover it, and they don't do it. They don't care to do it. Like I said, they just pass the buck and the blame. And then their argument is that, you know, that we don't care and that we just fight amongst each other and things like that. Well, you know, you limit the amount of guests and the people that we can have there, but then you take in people that are obviously going to be problematic in the first place. And you know, like, it just doesn't make sense, right? And then, yeah, it's supposed to be a stepping stone into something better, but it rarely ever goes to anything better, right? It rarely ever leads to anything to grow from, right? So that's, that's my problem, I guess, or that's my issue. Mm-hmm. We can walk around the park when I see it.
Sure.
And that was an interview done in December 2023, and we're replaying it today just because I think it gives you a good sense of what that encampment and other encampments meant to the people who lived there and how they addressed a need that they were not finding addressed through other solutions offered by the government and other services. One of the things really becomes evident when you start talking to the homeless and advocates for the homeless is that although solutions are offered, in many cases they really don't properly meet the needs of the individuals. Or respect their dignity, and the homeless persons who are homeless or unhoused, just like everyone else, need to be respected and included in the solutions that are created on their behalf. Crab Park encampment was closed down just over a week ago, and as a little clip we played before that interview with Clint Brandon there, folks are looking around for somewhere else to settle, and you can be certain that at some point, until real solutions are brought forth, homeless encampments will pop up again and again. It's only a matter of time.
Could I just add something to this?
Yep.
I think the law is that they have to take down the tents at a certain time in the morning, and then they're allowed to put them back up. I guess, but that's pretty cumbersome, but I think that...
Yeah, and that's often, you know, often how the authorities will prevent something from forming. But often, as with camps at Oppenheimer or at Strathcona Park or here at Crab Park, often when a group shows up en masse, they can kind of get themselves set up in a way that makes it much more difficult to remove it initially. So, very complicated issue. I, you know, sadly, You know, I don't think it's a problem. Homelessness or being unhoused is a problem that's going to go away anytime soon. But it's important to remember that, you know, to the extent we see it today, it hasn't always been the case. I mean, homelessness and whatnot has been pretty prevalent on our streets for the last 30 years or more. But for the most part, you know, before that, you know, particularly, you know, the closing down of institutions in the and defunding of certain services in the 1980s, I wouldn't go so far to say there were no homeless, because certainly they were, but they weren't in the numbers we see today, by any stretch. You know, so the idea that this is an inevitable problem that we can do nothing about simply isn't true. It's just a matter of deciding we want to do it. Senya is here, going to give us a little update on the weather. And what do you think? Does it look like a good week or not this week?
Oh, thank you. So it looks like today there's going to be a mix of sun and cloud with 30% chance of showers, high plus 5, UV index 1 or low. And tonight, showers expect a few wet flurries over higher terrain late this evening, and overnight low plus 2.
Great. Did anybody hear the thunder last night in your part of town?
I did not, no.
I didn't hear it at Lowried Mall. Right.
I live close to downtown, and there was one big boom at one point. It was pretty loud. So who knows what we get more. I didn't see any lightning, just the big boom of thunder.
It was raining pretty hard, but I didn't hear any lightning where I live. So.
Okay, well, the rest of the week looks pretty much the same, too, with clouds and rain. So bring your umbrella whenever you leave the house, or wear a good rain jacket so you're well prepared. Thanks for that, Senya.
Thank you so much for having me here again.
Great. Our next story is from our correspondent here, Danny Nesradu. And let's just head into that. How you can get, if you're in Burnaby, how you can get access to musical instruments.
Whether it be brass, woodwinds, strings, shakers, or even synthesizers, the sound of music has become much more accessible for Burnaby residents thanks to the Harmony for All program, which offers free instrument lending, music outreach programs, and community groups and scholarships for those wanting to participate in music lessons. Recently, the program won the Creative City Network of Canada's IDEA Award, which recognizes the significant contributions of any individual, organization, or municipality working in the cultural sector that exemplifies the principles of inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility through cultural programs. Since being recognized for this award, CJSF was able to sit down for an interview with Tanya Rankin, the Fine Arts Coordinator for the Harmony for All program, to speak on the inspiration behind the program as well as the ways in which they hope to grow in the future. Please take a listen to some of what she had to say.
It was actually inspired by one of our city councillors, Councillor Joe Keithley, who's the lead vocalist and guitarist for the punk band DOA. As a lover of music himself, he really felt the impact through his childhood and through adulthood being involved with music and feeling the connection that music brings, and that it's a universal language. You don't have to speak the same language or be interested in the same things. If you're connected through music, you can be connected anywhere with anybody. And he wanted that to be true for all of the residents of the city of Burnaby.
Next, during the interview, we asked Tanya Rankin whether there were any current barriers of entry for the program, as well as what the application process is like for instrument lending, musical education outreach programs, and the scholarship opportunities provided by the Harmony for All program.
It depends what you're wanting. So for the lending, anybody can apply. It's a quick and easy online application. And we just want to know what your intent is and why this is important to you. Tell us that, and then if we have the instrument you're requesting, we have 400 instruments, so there's a lot of options for people. Then we can get an instrument into your hands. With the scholarship program, because it's actually a financial commitment from the city of Burnaby, we do require proof of low income status for those individuals. So it's not a barrier, but more of an opening for people who are experiencing financial restrictions to getting music education. So people can borrow an instrument as well as get a scholarship to help pay for the lessons, which can be quite cost prohibitive mm-hmm. with lessons within the city of Burnaby. It's not cash towards the person. It's a lesson in our centers, and we'll help pay for it through the scholarships. The outreach program, there are no barriers. The organizations reach out to us, and if you're serving people who reside in the city of Burnaby, we'll come to you. We'll slot you into our calendar and bring a musical experience to those individuals.
Later on, Tanya explains what the community response has been to the Harmony for All program.
It's been really, really good. We have tried to get into all of the schools, the elementary and secondary schools, and let them know about the possibilities for renting an instrument, not renting, getting a loan of an instrument, a free loan of an instrument. And we are trying to get the word out to as many people as possible that if you live in the city of Burnaby, you can also borrow an instrument. The response from the organizations that serve people with barriers has been pretty phenomenal. They really are interacting with us the most. The 3,500 people we've now served are mostly going through that outreach component. And so all of the programs that we can bring to them, musicians, interactions with musical instruments, it has really made a difference to an awful lot of people who would otherwise never come into our centers.
Another question that we had for Tanya asked how the program was able to source all of these instruments to lend out to the community of Burnaby. Here's what she had to say in response to this.
I would say 99% of them were donated to the program.
Okay.
So when Councillor Keithley came up with this idea, he just put a call out in the local news and through radio ads saying, we're doing this donation drive. If you have instruments in your basement, in your closet, you're not playing anymore, please bring them to us. We're going to try and start a program. And he had hundreds of instruments donated. And then again, a couple of years ago, we did another large drive and another 250 instruments came in. And so we've used the funds connected to the program to service them all, repair those that could be repaired, and we've ended up with an inventory of 450 instruments just from all those donated instruments.
Wow.
And then through some of the outreach programs, we do some really interesting interactions with noisemakers. So we have purchased a number of percussion instruments so that people can always hold something, hit something, shake something, mm-hmm. whatever it is. A lot of the people we serve could have physical or cognitive disabilities, and just that ability to have something in their hand or be able to have something in front of them that they can touch has made a massive difference. So those specific things might not have necessarily been donated, but we've supplemented the instruments available. So we now have over 600 instruments available for people to experience.
Lastly, Tanya Rankin explained her enthusiasm regarding the possibility of other local cities adopting similar programs regarding lending out musical instruments. She even has an entire plan set out for those interested in looking into this process.
Absolutely. I've created a template on how to do it, and it wouldn't have to be exactly how we did it. We did it in three stages. We did it with three complete different components. Anybody could take one of those pieces and roll it out. And so what I'm encouraging people to do is contact the program, contact me, and I have it all created. I'm happy to share so other places could do it as well. It was so easy. It took time and just, you know, the time it takes to create anything new, but it's templated. All the hard work is done, and I'd be happy to share it with anybody that would be interested in duplicating it in other municipalities or anywhere.
Once again, that was CJSF in conversation with Tanya Rankin, the Fine Arts Coordinator for the Harmony for All program in Burnaby. Thank you all so much for tuning in. And once again, this piece would not be possible without the support from the Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece available on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to our very own LJI journalist, Danny, for that report. I'm glad to hear that Burnaby's counselor and Canadian punk rock icon, Joey Keithley, was a key proponent of that program. It fits very much with... seems very on point for him to be working to get musical instruments out
to his community.
I met
him in person, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
I went to a Burnaby Council meeting for the first time, and I briefly talked to him. Yeah. So there you go. Just to let us people know about that.
Yeah, I met him at a show many years ago, before he was a Burnaby councillor.
So first of all, I'd like to correct an error.
Yep.
That when we did last Monday, that was pre-recorded on the Thursday because it's a holiday, you can't get access here. All the votes had not come in, and now they only got 98.1% of the votes in. So here it is. Kamala Harris so far has gotten 73 million, over 73 million. Now, I was talking about 67 million.
Yeah.
And that sounded a bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2020, Joe Biden got over 81 million. So
yeah.
It's actually not such a come down for Kamala, I mean, compared for the Democrats. So that was an error because I should have got the point that the other years were all completed and this wasn't. So by accident, some misinformation got
But it still sort of leaves the key point that, you know, the Democrats got a lot less votes this time than they did 4 years ago.
Yeah, I know, but not as few as I was. And actually, Donald Trump got up again, over 76 million from the 74 million of 2020.
So Democrats are arguing vociferously about why that is. It's interesting debate.
Well, you know what? The popular vote as from the vote are 50.1% for Trump and 48.3% for Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of a bridging the gap, as it were. Now then, next week I'm going to bring up a controversial person, Denise Rancourt. Now, Denise Rancourt, who I met in 2008, challenged the as a self-proclaimed
anarchist,
left-wing anarchist. He actually taught physics at the University of Ottawa.
Yep.
He lost the post because he gave everybody an A+. There was a controversy behind that. But I had heard him, and he had reasons why he was critical of the climate change, kind of how it was done. And then, actually, he was critical of how COVID was done.
Mm-hmm.
But he was never an anti-vaxxer previous to that. Unlike John F. Kennedy Jr. has always...
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Robert Kennedy. Anyway, so I'm going to be before the next... next week, I'm going to talk about Denise Rancourt. But I'm going to differentiate me, and I hope that Denise Rancourt agrees with this. I'm going to talk a bit about the polio vaccine, the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, what that was, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So what it is that the polio vaccine doesn't as such say you're not going to get polio. It just means you're not going to get that devastating muscular problem.
Right.
And I actually met someone in 1989 who had contracted when he was a child, and he kind of had a bit of a limp, you know. for the rest of his life. So this was so that's kind of what it is. It's sort of I don't know, like but the autism link. I mean, there's a 1969 Elvis movie with Murray Tyler Moore playing a nun. What brings it up? One of the kids has actually autism, which is a fictional film, but it's interesting that it's back for 1969 in popular.
Did they have it? Did they bring it up by name?
Yes, but the child was diagnosed having autism, and Elvis Presley plays a medical doctor, which is a bit beyond. I mean, I don't know what's more unbelievable, Mary Tyler Moore as a nun or him as a doctor. Anyway, but anyway, it was presented in a popular culture. So, yeah. What is one thing about how the 1918 flu pandemic ended? I sort of was curious about that. So here, those previously who contracted the virus became immune to the new strands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 1938, they had created a flu vaccine, but then I did a bit of checking, and supposedly that flu vaccine wouldn't have done any help for the 1918 pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the controversy about COVID, as I was in thick in the water starting about May 2020, because someone I knew, I've known this guy for like 35 years sporadically on and off, but he said, I remember it was April or May 2020, hey, there's these people at Science World demonstrating, so I went there. No, but part of the argument was that you didn't need the vaccine because you would have immunity. And that's sort of one of the things that they said, or the arguments from our side. I mean, as I said a few months ago when I was saying why I haven't, I guess I'm a bit scared of the vaccine. It's funny, people are scared of getting COVID. I was more scared of the vaccine, and kind of what I heard about it could have been wrong or right. But it's interesting that pandemic just ended with what some people argued should have been with COVID.
I think one of the difficulties, though, and I'm not sure the particularities of the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, and maybe we don't even have that information because we didn't have the sort of scientific techniques to investigate each strain in the detail we can today. But, you know, one of the things about the more recent pandemic is that, you know, new strains kept coming along, so that your immunity to one strain wasn't necessarily guaranteed to offer you protection to the next strain. And similarly with the vaccines that they did, because, of course, you know, viruses and other things like that are constantly changing, because one of the ways they continue to proliferate is to try and change and evolves, you know, so that other protections that have emerged, whether they're natural immunity or not, become less effective. And of course, you know, it's a random process, but, you know, strains that evolve that can evade the previous protections are the ones that end up being successful and proliferate and become the next. Because you'll recall during the pandemic that each time, you know, typically, each wave that would happen, would be often involving new and different strains, and, you know, existing vaccines and I guess natural protection too were to varying degrees, you know, less effective than they had been with their earlier ones, because they're often targeted at a particular strain. You know, it's the same thing with the flu shot that we can get each year, right?
Yes.
You know, they keep coming up with a new one each year because the flu virus and the strains of the flu virus keep changing.
And none of them would have helped for the pandemic in 1918, supposedly.
No, because it would have been different than whatever we're dealing with now. And even with, you know, with the flu vaccine, it's not a guaranteed to work, because at the time they developed or producing and developing that vaccine, they're doing their best guess as to what's going to be effective with the upcoming year. But of course, until the flu shows up, they don't know exactly what it's going to be. So they're making their best guess. And if they get it right, then it offers a lot of protection. If they don't get it right, it doesn't offer that much protection. And that's just because at the time they settle on the one they're going to use, and then they have to manufacture it, they don't know exactly what they're dealing with. And they're making good guesses. And sometimes they guess bad guesses.
Also, kind of to put down John F. Robert Kennedy Jr., is that there was in 2019, there was a country where he said, don't get the measles vaccine, Samola, S-A-M-O-A, how do you say that?
Right.
And people got it, so. I mean, so I just want to clarify to those two people hearing me right now that I'm for the polio vaccine and the measles vaccine.
But you're personally worried about the COVID vaccine.
I'm unvaxxed, but to the max. So as far as COVID, but I actually had ages ago as a child the measles. And I got it on a sugar cube for the polio one. How about you, Magnus?
Yeah, well, you know, they do all those things through school, so I got all the...
No, the thing is that there's the vaccine, and there's but the oral technique for the...
I don't remember.
For the polio. It was on a sugar cube. They put it on a little...
All right. Well, thanks for that, Peter.
Okay.
We got one more report for you. We're going to take a look at how AI... is influencing the delivery of weather forecasts.
This community update was brought to you by U Multicultural. As climate change disrupts weather patterns in Manitoba, industries face increasing uncertainty. AI offers a promising solution. Winnipeg-based WeatherLogix sees the potential in employing AI to improve forecasting precision. Scott Kaler, president and chief scientist at WeatherLogix, explains.
And what AI is able to do is it's able to figure out how the weather is going to change in the future without actually knowing necessarily what these equations are. You just give it all the data and it figures out on its own how it's going to change in the future. And so this is allowing us to discover new things, because sometimes the equations we use have to be simplified in order for us to actually put them through the computer, whereas AI, you don't need to simplify it. You just give it the data and it will figure it out.
Though AI has shown promise in certain forecasting areas, short-term forecasting is still more accurate using traditional methods. These rely on numerical weather prediction models, which input physics equations into supercomputers to simulate future weather. This method has been the foundation of weather forecasting for decades. But Kaler believes AI may soon surpass these models as technology advances.
Now, there's still some work to be done, because for certain things like short-term forecasting, forecasting heavy rain or snow, they're still maybe not quite as good as our current approaches. But these models are developing so rapidly, and the whole AI field is developing so rapidly, that it wouldn't surprise me if that changed very quickly.
AI could be essential in anticipating extreme weather events across industries like agriculture, insurance, and transportation. Severe rainstorms and droughts have increased, and it's affecting farmers.
This year we saw that the winter was relatively dry. We didn't get a huge amount of snow, but then come spring, early summer, it actually did turn really wet for a while. Later in summer, it really dried out again, and now in fall, so far it has been fairly dry, but we just saw a big rain event. So farmers are having trouble, I think, more so just dealing with all these extremes, and that's a trend that we're seeing a lot in Manitoba, where, you know, just in recent years, we've gone from the wettest year on record to the driest year, almost back to back. And these are things that are potentially new and could cause a lot of difficulty in planning going forward.
Without reliable weather forecasts, farmers face crop failure, while insurance companies struggle to price accurately. As weather pattern shifts, premiums rise, and coverage may become harder to obtain, adding financial strain to Winnipeggers and all Manitoba residents.
These companies need to understand what the risk of severe weather events are, and if the risk of those events keeps changing over time, it makes it very hard for them to plan, you know, what their pricing should be. And the impact of that to the customer is quite negative, because over time, what that means is the price of insuring things is going to get more and more expensive. And for some people, it might get so expensive that they can't afford it anymore.
As for this winter, Kaler is unsure how the La Nina will affect things, but says the minus 40 temperatures that Winnipeggers often speak about could become a thing of the past, with Winnipeg only hitting minus 40 once in about the last 15 years. Whether or not these weather events become a trend is something Kaler is watching closely. With You Multicultural and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ryan Funk.
And we're just about out of time here at Speak Up. Thanks, everyone on the program. Thank you, Senya.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Magnus. Stay tuned for